KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. The Dark Secret Place. Brian sits here until 10 o'clock, live, covering the world melting down. Wait a minute. That's not Pussy Riot. This is Pussy Riot. No. Wait a minute. It gets worse. Let me just state for the record, I'm in complete support of Vladimir Putin's court in sentencing these people to 2 years for hooliganism. I would throw in horrible musicism were I a judge in the Moscow District Superior whatever people's something or other. I have no idea, but 2 years is what they get. And you know what they get for the American entertainment sector? They get outrage, I say. Outrage. Real outrage that Vladimir Putin might feel? No. That might require sacrifice. No, what they get is fists in the air and longer breaks during concerts and things like that. That's what Pussy Riot gets from the American entertainment sector. Of course, Madonna on tour right now, she was seen with the words Pussy Riot on her back. And she's being photographed with that. Everyone thinks that that is some great significant thing. I'd like to point out for the record, Madonna has had Pussy Riot written on her back since roughly 1988. Hey, thank you. Good night. We'll be here all week. Anyway, bottom line on Pussy Riot. This is one of those Russian internal matters that gets better if we shut up. The even inside of Russia, the pressure that Putin gives a damn about is not what Madonna writes on her back or her tramp stamp or this space for rent or, you know, whatever she has on her back. It's what is happening internally. And what is happening internally is that the Russians are kind of the Russian authorities are a little surprised at the prominent people who are coming forward to be arrested, like Garry Kasparov, former world chess master, who was arrested, detained for hours and hours because he was there at the sentencing of some really crappy punk band that American TV networks won't even say the name of. And by the way, their name is not mistranslated. They don't have a name in Russian. The name of the group are the two English words, Pussy Riot. That is their name in Russian. So there's that. So I would just recommend to the vast members of the American entertainment community, don't wear a ribbon, don't have a concert, don't do any of the things that make Vladimir Putin circle the wagons. Just be quiet. Just donate money to their legal defense fund and donate money to closing the barn door after the bulls escaped while you're at it, all right? But anyway, there's a punk rock band, and you're hearing about it in the news. And the proximate cause for their arrest and conviction is that they trespassed in the holiest Russian Orthodox church there in Red Square, St. Michael's, and without permission filmed 40 seconds of their video. And that was the judge even mentioned it was an affront to the Christian world and all that. So best thing to do for these three young women is to not make it a big deal, because this is not the Cold War. This is the new, not Cold War. And this is definitely not at this time in history, not really worth making the Russians circle the wagons even more than they have, because there's two big irons in the fire where we require the Russians to at least be so put off by what their support has done that they're supposed to either not vote on the Security Council or vote our way. Thing one is Syria, because they've been blocking action in Syria, so have the Chinese. And thing two is Iran. So we kind of need them more than we need more really horrible Russian punk rock. I think they got off lucky with 2 years. So anyway, there's Pussy Riot. At 8:30, we're going to speak with the author of a fairly remarkable book, Dan King, who is a native-born American guy who has been awarded the highest rank as a spoken and written practitioner of the Japanese language by the Japanese government. The guy speaks fluent Japanese, and he did something fairly remarkable. He went to Japan and he interviewed surviving Japanese pilots from World War II, and he wrote the book, The Last Zero Fighter. And we'll talk to him at 8:30 about what he learned and what we can learn from the book. And also, yes, a prisoner in Guantanamo is complaining because another Guantanamo convictee or another Guantanamo inmate has a cat. And he's spilling the beans on the guy who has a cat. Also, a four-star general, the details on this guy's lavish spending are coming out as well. And Bibi Netanyahu's war plan is front and center, I should say. But actually, top of the news today is, guess what, if it's Saturday, here's the latest outrage in Syria. And this is really no surprise to anyone. Assad continues to use his air force. And what's interesting about this, and I think what the American media and even Al Jazeera and others don't get, is that Assad is not putting into the air his most capable aircraft. He's putting into the air the aircraft that are most easily flown, that he can most afford to lose. And also, what drives that is the fact that he's not allowing anybody in the cockpit of a Syrian aircraft if they are not a member of the Alawite or Christian community, because he can't trust anybody right now but Alawites and Christians. If he put somebody else in the cockpit of a fighter plane and put weapons on it, they might turn around and bomb him. That's very actually his concern. But anyway, another day, another bombing strike, another. And you have to consider, in Syria, it's not collateral damage when you kill a woman and her three children. That's a direct hit.
Around Syria's most populous city, Aleppo, the death toll continues to mount. These pictures were filmed by activists. A Syrian fighter jet flies overhead after appearing to drop two bombs on the city below.
And what you have is the Czech-built L-39 Dolphin trainer and combat aircraft in wide civilian use in the United States. There's two or three of them sitting right now at Van Nuys. If you have the money, you can call and you can fly in the back seat, I think, for an hour or something like that. One of them crashed in Arizona last year. They're easily mastered. Not hyper expensive, but very popular aircraft, very well built, well designed, beautiful little plane. And the Syrians sure love them to bomb civilians. And that's what you have, this thing, a single plane. And this is one thing that I've noticed over and over and over in all this video, is it is aircraft flying singly, or it's the same plane making multiple runs. I'm not seeing, as you saw in the 90s, when the Russians hit a target from the air, multiple aircraft came in, or never mind that, 2008, when 2010, Beijing, what? No, 2008, when the Russians hit a target in Georgia, multiple planes came in. Not one plane making the same loop or whatever, multiple planes came in. The Syrians apparently have one operable plane or one competent pilot or something like that. And so that's one thing that I noticed from all the video I've seen today.
This man searches through the rubble of a house believed to have been hit by a missile fired by a Syrian helicopter. The Syrian government maintains it's fighting terrorists, but these are the people it killed here, a woman and her three children.
So you're saying they can't be terrorists? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be flippant about this because it's horrific, but it's now gone on for 19 months or so. And with Kofi Annan officially fully quit, now a new envoy comes in, Ibrahim, from, where is he from? From Tunisia. Good luck. Best of luck there, dude. The Organization of Islamic Countries took a firm stand yesterday, and they kicked Syria out. And I'm sure that is the straw that's going to break Assad's back and et cetera. Ultimately, I still hold by what I have heard, that they're floating a plan to Assad where they simply redraw the map of Syria and they carve out an Alawite ethnic concentration, and he steps down and becomes the greenskeeper of the golf course or whatever. He keeps his money. He gets immunity. He doesn't have to leave. And he also has a, there's a promise that he never leaves. If he sets foot in Monte Carlo or Peru, he'll be arrested. So he sits there and he basically is in jail in the Alawite Syria. In the meantime, the longer it takes to come to a resolution in Syria, the stronger, by the way, al-Qaeda gets in Syria, because they are now not just bringing fighters who have been some of the more effective guys, but they're bringing in more and more weapons. They're helping refugees, etc. And so what the United States is trying to do, what we are doing, as you'll hear that we donated $50 million in non-lethal foreign aid. Yeah, that's great. You know, that's tents, hospitals, drinking water, all that kind of thing. What you're not hearing about are the emergency expenditures, the emergency budget items that are going to Turkey, because the Turks make very, very good licensed copies of, for instance, Stinger missiles, the FIM-92 Alpha and Bravo. That's the nomenclature of the Stinger missile. We're not giving Stinger missiles to the Free Syrian Army. We're paying Turkey to make a run of several thousand Stinger missiles, and then those are finding their way to the Free Syrian Army trainees who are being trained in Turkey as we speak. We're paying the Turks to do a couple runs of Russian-designed but Turkish-built anti-tank missiles, things like that. That is how this kind of thing is accomplished. So that way you can say to a camera, we're not providing lethal aid. What we are doing is we're paying for someone else to provide lethal aid. That's how that works. And that's what we're doing. Hopefully, the teams that are on the ground in Turkey, their primary function is to make sure those weapons get into the correct hands. Now, once they cross the line into Syria, there's no guarantee. And here's me just putting myself in the enemy's shoes. If I were al-Qaeda, just like Libya was a jihad magnet and a, you know, hey, look at all the loose weapons lying around magnet, so is Syria the same thing, but not just because of the goodies you might get from the Assad regime, but because of the flood of arms coming from Turkey that the U.S. is paying for. All you have to do is sit there and ambush some of these Free Syrian Army guys, or better yet, lie and say you're one of them and get them yourself. So it's hopefully we're not opening up Pandora's box on this. It was managed fairly well in Libya, so far so good. But a year from now, if an airliner was shot down with a shoulder-fired missile, dollars to donuts, it didn't come from Afghanistan. Remember, we spent the last couple of years being afeared that the Mujahideen, who we gave all these missiles to in the 80s, that one of them would be turned on an American commercial airliner somewhere. The thing I fear now is one of those weapons that came from Libya, or one of the ones that we're paying for out of Turkey, finds its way to the approach pattern at LAX on the beach or something. That's what I'm afeard of. We'll be back in just a minute. Bibi Netanyahu's secret war plan. How do you conduct a war against Iran when it's just Israel in 30 days? He spelled it out in a pitch, supposedly, and it was leaked somehow. Well, there's a response from the White House. We'll have it all right after this. And author Dan King, the author of The Last Zero Fighter, will have him at 8:30. It is a dark secret place. Brian suits in here until 10 p.m. on KFI. AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Can't get past the screener? Go to the official KFI AM 640 Facebook page now.
KFI, more stimulating talk radio.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. What about Puppy Riot? We never hear about them. That's a cute group. Brian Zoops here on The Dark Secret Place, our weekly look at the world melting down. And you need a dry erase board to keep track of who's pissed off about whose citizens are on what disputed island. Remember, last week it was the president of South Korea landing on a disputed island controlled by Japan. 3 days ago, Chinese citizens landed on a different island controlled by Japan. They've been deported. And now Japanese civilians are making a point of pride and nationalism by landing on the island with members of parliament. And it's big things happen where they started as small things like this. It's funny watching this go spin out of control at the hands of citizens with outboard motors going to these disputed islands. But we'll get to that. How about a very actual potential war? All right, well, a blog released what they claim to be a talking point memo spelling out how a 30-day war would go. That in the Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet, within the cabinet, there's a ultra cabinet, a war cabinet of seven members. And the word is that right now it is 4-3 against initiating a preemptive attack against the Iranian nuclear facilities. And so Netanyahu prepared a document that according to the blogger and an Israeli newspaper, an IDF, a Israel Defense officer, released this. And another Israeli ministry-level guy confirmed that he heard this Israeli outline for a 30-day conflict with Iran. And this is what it says, quote, "The Israeli attack will open with coordinated strikes, including an unprecedented cyber attack, which will totally paralyze the Iranian regime and its ability to know what is happening within its borders. The internet, telephones, radio, and television, communication satellites, and fiber optic cables leading to and from critical installations, including underground missile bases at Khorramabad and Isfahan, will be taken out of action. The electrical grid throughout Iran will be paralyzed, and transformer stations will absorb severe damage from carbon fiber munitions, which are finer than human hair, causing electrical short circuits, whose repair requires their complete removal. This would be an impossible task in light of cluster munitions, which would be dropped, some time delayed and some remote activated through the use of a satellite signal. Next, a barrage of tens of ballistic missiles would be launched from Israel towards Iran. 300-kilometer range cruise missiles would be launched from Israeli submarines in the vicinity of the Persian Gulf. The missiles would not be armed with unconventional warheads, nuclear, but rather with high-explosive ordnance equipped with reinforced tips designed specifically to penetrate hardened targets. The missiles will strike their targets, some exploding above ground, like those striking the nuclear reactor at Arak." This is back in 2007 when the Israelis destroyed the Syrian nuclear facility that was being constructed, as well as nearby heavy water production facilities. See, nuclear fuel production facilities at Isfahan and facilities for enriching uranium hexafluoride. Others would explode underground. Now, we go to phase three. "A barrage of hundreds of cruise missiles will pound command and control systems, research and development facilities, and the residences of senior personnel in the nuclear and missile development apparatus. Intelligence gathered over years will be utilized to completely decapitate Iran's professional and command ranks in these fields. After the first wave of attacks, which will be timed to the second, the blue and white radar satellite." The Israelis launched a satellite in 2007 with apparently a fairly extraordinary reconnaissance ability. "The blue and white radar satellite, whose systems enable us to perform an evaluation of the level of damage done, will pass over Iran. Only after rapidly decrypting the satellite's data will the information be transferred directly to warplanes, making their way covertly to Iran." So in other words, they're going to take off without a specific target. The satellite, the blue and white radar satellite, blue and white, of course, the colors of the Israeli flag, will coordinate what targets they're going to concentrate on. "These IAF planes," Israel Air Force, "will be armed with electronic warfare gear previously unknown to the wider public, not even revealed to our U.S. ally. This equipment will render Israeli aircraft invisible. Those Israeli warplanes which participate in the attack will damage a short list of targets which require further assault. Among the targets approved for attack, the Shihab-3 ballistic missile silos, storage tanks for chemical components, etc." So, so, in some ways, geographically, fairly specific. Kind of reckless to release something that talks about the fiber optic lines leading from this place or that place, because maybe the Iranians take a week and a half and just reroute the fiber optic lines. I don't know. But there also might be another reason this was released, that it was intentionally leaked to force the White House's hand, because according to an Israeli website, the White House has come up with a deal to prevent the Israelis from striking Iran before the American presidential election. That even the White House, even Barack Obama, feels that that would cost him the election if the Israelis did it, which is kind of Netanyahu's point. And so in doing so, according to an Israeli website, an agreement has been shaken on that the United States in the spring will strike Iran, double dog serious, no fingers crossed, that the United States promises to strike Iran in the spring after Barack Obama's reelection, if that is to occur. And in between then and now, to provide Israel with the technology to do it successfully upon their, in other words, to double down that promise by giving the Israelis the more effective means to do it, so that if we don't do it in the spring, the understanding is the Israelis can go and do it all they want. That is where we stand as of this Saturday night. When we come back, we'll get back to this, by the way. There's a lot more to talk about with this. But when we come back, a really interesting book, and I'm a big fan of viewing war from the eyes of the enemy, to learn how to think like your enemy, either historic enemies or current enemies, etc. And author Dan King from Orange County has written The Last Zero Fighter. He, in Japanese, a fluent Japanese speaker, interviewed Japanese World War II fighter pilots and has come up with a really unique book. We'll talk to him right after this on The Dark Secret Place. And in the KFI newsroom, Michael Crozier has the latest.
Coast to Coast AM, tonight at 10.
KFI, more stimulating talk radio.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio, The Dark Secret Place. And from time to time, I read a lot of books, and from time to time, I read one that requires talking to the author. This is the book, The Last Zero Fighter, by Dan King. Dan King was a summer exchange student in Japan in 1981. He obtained his bachelor's degree in Japanese before working at Toyota Motors for 15 years. His expertise of the Japanese written and spoken language earned him the Japanese Ministry of Education's top level of written and spoken language for non-natives. He also, by the way, has worked as a technical and historical consultant on films such as Windtalkers, The Last Samurai, Flags of Our Fathers, the Clint Eastwood film, Only the Brave, as well as a language consultant and voiceover guy for The Pacific, the HBO series that KFI's very own Dale Dye worked on. Dan King joins us from his secret home in Orange County. Dan, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So here's what the book is for people who missed when I was talking about it earlier. The book, The Last Zero Fighter, part one, I guess, is you're sitting down in Japanese with living men, surviving fighter pilots, Japanese fighter pilots of World War II. And I looked, and you're absolutely right. Nobody has ever done this. Maybe it's been translated, maybe transliterated from their written word, but no one has ever no American in their language has sat down, even after action reports from the U.S. Navy and the Air Corps in World War II, nobody has sat down and taken their oral memoirs. So what made you do this?
You know, it was something that I thought was missing in our own World War II history. As I love World War II, Pacific War history, and I think it's fascinating. But even when I was a teenager, I wanted to read more about it, but there were just no books. And you know, the more I searched, the more I realized there was a big gap from the Japanese side. And it seems like if you want to study any battle, you need to know both sides. And we knew our side, but there was just so little information out there on the Japanese side. And you know, when I lived in Japan, I would meet these World War II veterans. They were often relatives or friends of relatives or coworkers, et cetera. And I thought, these guys' stories are incredible. I got to put these down. And I'd been assembling these interviews for about 25 years. And I put these five naval aviators into this first book, The Last Zero Fighter, because to me, they were the epitome of the Pacific War and the Japanese experience. You know, Mr. Harada, he was in the Navy before the war even started in the mid-30s. And he was at the USS Panay attack in Nanking, and he went all the way through to the end of the war.
So speaking of that guy, I had the impression from growing up as an American, son of a Pacific War veteran, and just a huge airplane fan. As a kid, I read Baba Black Sheep, and I went to an air show in Everett, Washington, and got to meet Pappy Boyington when he was signing books, back when the TV series was red hot and everything. I was just steeped in all the American lore, and I had the assumption that the Japanese lost every single competent pilot by the end of the war, that they didn't have any surviving veterans. But the first guy in your book not only was trained prior to the war, he's one of the Japanese fighter pilots that shot down the legendary Torpedo 8. The squadron wiped out at Midway to a man, for a single man. But their sacrifice was significant because all the fighters were down at sea level, and within a span of minutes, dive bombers came in and hit three of the four Japanese aircraft carriers. And for people who don't know, there was a span of 6 minutes on the 4th of June, 1942. On the 4th of June, 1942, in a 6 minute span, the Pacific War was decided. If from that point forward, it was basically all, it was just running out the clock. For, I don't want to be insensitive to veterans of Okinawa, et cetera, but for the Japanese, had they been able to look in the mirror and realize what happened, they would have realized the war was lost in 6 minutes. And this guy was there. This guy was part of it, and he's in your book.
And Mr. Hirata, he talks in detail about what happened that day when he was flying combat air patrol over the fleet. And he was actually disappointed because he wanted to be in the attack in Midway. Because at Pearl Harbor, he'd been combat air patrol, missed out on all the action, was very bitter and frustrated. And so at Midway, he was going to miss out on all the action again. But he finds himself over the fleet, combat air patrol, and here come these torpedo bombers. And he said that we Japanese were more afraid of torpedoes than we were of dive bombers, because the ships could turn circles and kind of take care of themselves and get away from dive bombers. The torpedo bombers, you know, because they had such fantastic torpedoes on the Japanese side, that he assumed we had the same torpedoes.
So for people who don't know, at the outbreak of World War II, the Japanese had the best, fastest, longest range, most accurate torpedoes on Earth, and we pretty much had the crappiest ones.
Well, so Mr. Hirata, they all went after these, you know, torpedo bombers, and he talks about shooting them down. It's so many years later, he still has the painful expressions on his face because he saw the man he shot down, and he lost one of his wingmen in the process. And he has nightmares about the people that he shot down, and talks about Midway and what a total disaster it was, and that they had basically lost the war there at Midway, as you had said, in June 1942.
And then, this gentleman, Mr. Hirata, you say in the end notes, as of June of this year, as of 2 months ago, far as he's still alive.
Yep, he had his sword bared his 96th birthday last Saturday.
I'm a big defender of reading about war from the other perspective, because you learn more about yourself by reading the words of your former foe. What was the overall of the men you talked to, even if you discount the, you know, being a good host factor, because you went to, by and large, you went to their homes, right?
Yeah, yes, I did. Yeah.
So if you factor out the good host factor, honestly, objectively, what did they think of the Americans they were facing in the sky?
Well, you know, that was one thing that I talked to the veterans about. I said, don't talk to me as an American. Please tell me what you felt at the time. And sometimes it's difficult for me to hear them talk about shooting down American pilots, because I'm an American, and I have relatives who fought, you know, in World War II. On the American side. And it was difficult at times, but I told them, I won't judge you. I'm not going to write anything negative about you. I'm not going to put my own opinions into the story. What you tell me, I'll write down. And by and large, they all said that the pilots on the American side, and that includes the British, New Zealanders, Canadians, were flying planes that weren't as good as the Japanese planes. They said they were brave, but they just didn't have as good machines. And later on in the war, when the Americans got the F-6F Hellcat, everything changed. And several of the fighter pilots I interviewed said, when they saw Wildcats in the sky, they thought, okay, let's go get them, boys. You know, this is easy pickings. But when they encountered the Hellcats, everything changed. And they would try to avoid combat with the Hellcats if possible.
And then, just because we learned early and were very flexible back in World War II, and were able to pivot very quickly and come up with a better aircraft and put it in the air. It was technically the aircraft were that better, and the Japanese couldn't match it.
I think there's a couple of things that made the Wildcat, the Hellcat, so powerful. Is one, they had the six 50 caliber machine guns, They had armor for the wing tanks, the pilot, and the engine. And the Zero had no armor at all. None. For the pilot, for the tanks, for the engine. And a Zero could hit a Hellcat several times and never set it on fire. But one of the common complaints from the Japanese Zero pilots was that we get a couple hits from the Hellcat and we're burning like a torch. And if you get in a turning fight with a Hellcat, you can turn in, you can hit him a few times and set him smoking and he'll take off. But the Hellcats learn to dive through Japanese formations and keep going. They make a hit and keep going. Whereas the Japanese were taught to get like a python, that coil, and try to get like a vertical dog fight. And the Americans refused to play the Japanese game. And like you said earlier, the Japanese did not have the numbers. You couldn't trade man for man with the Americans.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about pilot quality and why it led to the Japanese inability to replace pilot losses versus how the Americans had virtually an assembly line that created high-quality pilots and the differences between that philosophy. Dan King is the author of The Last Zero Fighter. He's in Orange County. We'll talk to him when we come back right after this on The Dark Secret Place, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Get the new iHeartRadio app for your iPad or smartphone.
At KFIAM640.com.
Listen to KFI wherever you go, even in the jungle.
Welcome to the jungle. KFI, more stimulating talk radio.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. The Dark Secret Place. Brian sits in here till 10 o'clock. We'll talk more about the memo leaked / released by the Israelis about a 30-day war with Iran. That scenario next hour. But our guest is Dan King from Orange County. He's the author of The Last Zero Fighter, Volume 1. He interviewed surviving Japanese pilots from World War II in their language, in their homes, and put down their oral memoirs in a really fascinating book. And one of the things that we were talking about off air a little while ago was that the Japanese had a really thorough pilot training system. They had multiple ways, and this started in the 20s and the 30s, and I learned this from your book, by the way. I'm not sitting here talking like I'm a colleague on this particular thing, but as I learned from your book, they took naval aviation and the development and training of pilots very, very seriously from an early time. So why don't you describe how they came up with their naval aviators and their army aviators?
Well, the large majority of the naval pilots and aviators were taken from high school boys who were average age 16 years old. And the training period was about 2.5 years long. And what they would do is they would take these boys, they'd give them the equivalent of basically a current day, maybe junior college education, and teach them how to fly, or teach them how to be a radio man or an observer / navigator. So about 10% of the pilots were officers. The other 90% were enlisted men or petty officers. And it seems that most of the better pilots were the guys who had been enlisted men and petty officers, because they had been in the air much longer than the officers. But
To make it clear to people, they had a program for current serving enlisted men, and the life of an enlisted sailor in the Japanese Navy was brutal. It was ugly.
Right.
And if you were a smart enough, sharp enough guy, you could take a test and go in. That was one way. Another way was just to basically, as you say, come off the street at the age of 15 or 16.
Exactly, yes. They had two ways to get into the Navy Air Program. One, if you were like a high school kid, you could join as a civilian with your parents' permission, or you could be in the Navy as a sailor, serve for at least a year, and then apply, take a test to get into the aviation course. And most of the pilots we read about took either one of those two paths.
And, of course, they had a Naval Academy, and just like we do in that, well, that was thought to be... The idea was that was going to produce the best naval aviators. So what was the philosophy here? Was they thought the war was going to be won by the side that had the absolute top of the line, most excellent pilots possible?
Many of the pilots, they talked about the frustration they felt because they felt that aviation was the future. As America, as the Japanese taught us, the battleship age had ended at Pearl Harbor, but the Japanese were still building these gigantic battleships. And in the Japanese Navy, promotions came quicker to men who served on destroyers and cruisers and battleships. If you were a pilot You know, it was harder to get command. It was harder to get promoted. And a lot of the pilots complained that their own Navy was still lagging behind the Americans, even though the Japanese had taught us that the air power had come of age. They were very frustrated with that. So they focused on, you know, the Naval Academy and, you know, producing more battleships and, you know, big seagoing vessels. And they kind of fell behind on a training pilot.
And also, it seems that just like the land forces, that philosophy was based on the Japanese historic concept of a war being one big, single, decisive battle on a sunny day. Not a war that goes on for 3.5 years where you lose your core of experienced pilots and you have to replace them. All wars are decided either by a mystical tsunami sinking the enemy fleet, or you, through brilliance and wile and tactics, corner him, and in a single day, you devastate him. So whoever shows up with the best guys is going to win such a war.
Exactly. You know, one example is Mr. Harada. When he got out of his aviation training course and he went over to China, he had 300 hours. No. But then Mr. Kasai, who's in the last chapter, when he went down to Guam, he had 50 hours of flight time. And Mr. Kasai, he was saying that, you know, we were like little chicks, like fledgling little baby birds, and we could barely fly in formation without bumping into each other, and we're sent down to Guam. And a majority of his comrades were wiped out in the Marianas turkey shoot. And he said it just wasn't fair. We had planes that were unarmored. We had guys who could barely fly in formation, and we were set down into combat against American pirates who were trained and were flying excellent quality machines. And they had excellent aviation gas. Well, our aviation gas was pretty sketchy. And they had radar. We didn't. And their intelligence was incredible, and ours is non-existent. And he just felt like, I wish I could have been on the winning side at least once during the war. And I thought it was really interesting that he would admit that from the time he joined the Navy, he was always, you know, losing every battle they were in.
What about the fact that we had really hot chicks with big boobs painted on the side of our planes? Was that in any way, did that distract them in air-to-air combat?
You know, none of them mentioned that. Not
one of them did. Because in all the pictures I ever see of Japanese aircraft, you know, the Russians did it even. The Germans did, you know, they put Stalin in a bra. The Germans did it. The Brits did it. We did it. I've never seen a picture of a Japanese fighter with an attractive, you know, geisha or something on the side of the aircraft.
Well, you know, one thing is that Japanese pilots didn't have their own assigned aircraft. The aircraft were assigned to the squadron. And so you'd get whatever was available that day. And so they were not, you know, they weren't putting things on their planes. They weren't personalized. And also, something like that would be viewed as, like, disrespectful towards the emperor, because he owned everything you used.
Oh,
whether
yeah, there's
your
that.
Rifle, everything belonged to the emperor. And so, you know, during the basic training, these guys could get beat hard. If they dropped, like they dropped their hat on the ground, that belonged to the emperor, and they would get slapped and beat. And, you know, I don't know if you've heard about, you read in the book about the bat they used in basic training. They called it the bat to instill military spirit. And it was like an old policeman's club, you know, from the Chicago days, you know. And the instructors would come about and would just bash these kids on their butts. They'd have them put their hands against the wall and bend over, and they'd hit every kid in the little platoon across in his buttocks to teach him a lesson. Every pilot had his butt beat many, many times that way. They
and
were
that,
slapped and they were beat.
That went out in the U.S. Navy in 2006. That's what I've heard. Well, the book is The Last Zero Fighter. The author is Dan King. The Last Zero Fighter, Volume 1. I wanted to talk more about your work on some World War II films, so maybe we'll have you back. To talk about that. We talk about a lot about movies. I want to know why Wind Talker was such a piece of crap. So now that I want to put you on the spot, I just want to know why John Woo had such phenomenal material and was able to make a crappy movie out of it. But no fault of your own. Anyway, available, of course, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I, in no way, shape, or form, am getting a piece of the action whatsoever. Maybe someday I'll get a beer out of it. But I just want the audience to know that. The link I put up on Dark Secret Place Facebook page, I don't get a piece of that, so don't do that to me. But it's a terrific book, The Last Zero Fighter, Dan King from Orange County, joining us on a Saturday night. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll be back next hour. The Israeli war plan, plus a little bit more about why you should read books from the enemy's perspective and books about military failures, not about successes, but about failures. That and more, and a quick and dirty reading list on that. Right after this, on The Dark Secret Place, Brian Suits filling in on KFI. Filling in. That's a reflex from Conway. Brian Suits, the host of The Dark Secret Place, as it turns out, on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Michael Crozier with the news now. KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. The Dark Secret Place. Brian Suits in here until 10 o'clock. And our thanks to Dan King, the author of The Last Zero Fighter, Volume 1. As I say, I am obsessed with translations of former foes' memoirs of fighting Americans. And here's the reason why. You always hear the phrase, history is written by the victors, you know, and all that. Well, basically what it boils down to is you don't learn a lot from a success. You don't look critically at successes because everything works, especially in the military. No, you know, the Giants don't look critically at the Super Bowl. Go, okay, we won. But could we have won bigger? You don't do that. D-Day, there were cock-ups of the first water, as the British say, on D-Day, June 6, 1944, unforeseen. What was done? Well, there were some sects of the United States Army that said, how come we didn't foresee certain things? Let's look back to the planning process and find out why we didn't foresee certain things. What I'm saying is you learn more in a loss than you learn in a victory. The U.S. Army of June 1950 that faced the North Koreans was basically unchanged from the U.S. Army that ended in August of 1945. The U.S. Army of 1991 that liberated Kuwait and destroyed the Iraqi army was vastly different from the U.S. Army of 1973 that left Vietnam. It was a cathartic experience for the U.S. Army, the getting rid of the draft and relying on a volunteer force. Over the past 11 years, the U.S. military has, in some instances, done very well at examining failures, and in other instances, has done a really good job of covering up some failures, like the Battle of Wannat in Afghanistan. So what I'm saying is I'm making the argument that you learn more from reading your enemies' memoirs of fighting you, as well as reading about failures. One of my favorite books of all time is called Hell in a Very Small Place by a French author by the name of Bernard Fall, F-A-L-L. It's an English book. It was written in English. He wrote the thing in English. He was a premier historian of Southeast Asia, but the book is about the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the pivotal moment in history when the French Empire was forced because of military defeat to hand over Indochina to the communist Viet Minh and effectively hand over the Cold War watchtower of Indochina to the United States. So why did we take that baton? Because the French lost. Why did the French lose? Because they were stupid and arrogant. Why were they stupid and arrogant? I don't know. They shouldn't have been. World War II should have been a cathartic experience for them. But it was not. And they were arrogant, and they underestimated their enemy. And the book, Hell in a Very Small Place, gives you the if I was running a graduate school for business, for MBAs, and I was talking about organization, like there's a friend of mine who spent a lot of money to get his MBA at a very large West Coast university. And he said, it was 2.5 years. The most productive 2 hours he spent in graduate school, 2.5 hours he spent in graduate school, was when they watched the movie, the James Stewart movie, Flight of the Phoenix. The movie about a cargo plane crashing in Libya, and then they have to cobble together. They have to find all the different skills of everybody who survived and piece together an airplane and fly to safety. It's a textbook movie about management. Well, same with reading about the failure of the French in Indochina. And as you read the book, if you reread the book, and you have to be, you really have to be kind of a history wonk, and you have to be prepared to stop and go to Wikipedia and look up certain things and all this. But effectively what happens is you see basically a ship being built. And they start at the keel and they do the hull. And as they're building upwards, they're leaving gaping holes in the hull. And then they get to the superstructure, and they make this magnificent superstructure with beautiful staterooms. And everyone's standing around saying, what about those holes? Because I'm no naval architect, but ships don't float when they have holes in the hull. And everyone said, not my job. I'm in charge of polishing the railings. I'm painting the smokestack. But you see that guy up there at the top of the dry dock? He's in charge of the whole thing. Surely we have to trust him. He'll see the holes. Don't worry about it. Just keep driving. Well, that's basically what happened in Dien Bien Phu, and that is a very common thing in all military failures. So that book, Hell in a Very Small Place, by Bernard Fall, is a tremendous one. Recently, there is a book called The Soviet Afghan War, and effectively, what it was this fairly amazing, remarkable scholar by the name of Lester Grau. He lives and works at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Works for the U.S. Army Center for Army Lessons Learned and all that. As far as I know, he's a monk. But all he does is translate from Russian to English Russian manuals and combat reports from the Cold War, etc. But he cobbled together. He got a hold of the Russian debrief of their experience in Afghanistan around 1995. The Soviet General Staff got together and had the intellectual honesty when they were able to get the party hacks out of the room. They got together and they said, hey, we need to sit down and put pen to paper about what worked in Afghanistan and what did not work and why it didn't work. Well, he translated that into English. It's called the Soviet-Afghan War by Lester Grau, G-R-A-U. And it's a tremendous book, because especially in light of what's going on right now, because you see the Russians learning, don't trust the roads, but then don't lean too much on your helicopters, because they'll learn to shoot them down and things like that. So I'm making the argument, like I'm having a debate at a historical society, that you do learn a lot more from the losses, from your own as well as your enemy's losses, and you'll ever learn from a victory, because writing a book about a victory is all about assigning glory and credit and the whole thing. In the case of World War II, in as far as the American machine fighting the Japanese machine, had the Japanese possessed the ability to be honest about themselves, they would have seen the weaknesses that were going to lose the war to them well before they ever dropped a bomb on Pearl Harbor. And the primary weakness was their inability, their arrogance, their inability to respect their enemy. The Japanese on the land and in the air and on the sea never considered the individual American to be the equal of the Japanese. And any planning that a Japanese staff officer did with that assumption that the Americans were equal would be the end of his career. When the Japanese were wargaming Pearl Harbor, if anyone ever said, all right, let's throw in a wild card, let's say one of our carriers is sunk, that very notion would get the guy laughed off the exercise. And if a Japanese staff officer said, you know what, we're down to 70 planes and 70 pilots, maybe we should hold back on another attack. Maybe we should wait till we're reinforced, because the Americans have 300 pilots and 300 planes. He probably would have been told to go downstairs and eat a sword. Because what are you saying? Are you saying that they are our equal, or that we're not better than three of them? And the other thing, this philosophy thing that I'm pointing out with the Japanese, not only did it infect their planning and make it before one shot was fired in the Pacific, make it a done deal that the Japanese would lose because they couldn't replace their losses, it also affected how they built their ships. This is what's really weird. American ships in World War II, right up to this day, have superb damage control. When American aircraft carriers went into combat or were under attack by enemy aircraft, All the fuel lines were drained, and they were filled with inert gas, non-flammable gases, right? Not the Japanese carriers. And not only that, but the American crews. Ask anybody who's been at sea in the Navy. What do you do during downtime? What do you train on? You train on damage control. The cooks, everybody. Not in the Japanese Navy, and you know why? Because if you suggested maybe we should practice damage control, you would be branded a defeatist because you're considering the possibility that the enemy can damage us. It's ridiculous on the face of it, isn't it? But that is one of the institutional things, one of the reasons that the Japanese lost. That was a Japanese Achilles heel. The German Achilles heel, historically, for the past 500 years, is an inability to tell an incompetent commander that he sucks at what he does, especially when they put a uniform on. They can't do that. The American Achilles heel, and I've talked about this, is we want everybody on Earth to like us, and we just don't understand why people don't. When we come back, a four-star general, we have this detail. The Army is considering prosecution of recently retired General William Kip Ward. He overspent his budget. The Army is considering demoting him so he would be a retired three-star instead of a four-star. What did he spend your money on? I have some of it here. Also, a Guantanamo detainee is complaining because his cellie has a cat, and he doesn't have a cat. You're not supposed to have a cat, but he knows of a guy who has a cat because he cooperated with the Americans, and that's an outrage. That and more coming up. It is the Dark Secret Place. Brian Suits here until 10 p.m. on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Get the new iHeartRadio app for your iPad or smartphone.
KFIAM640.com.
And listen to KFI wherever you go, even walking on the moon.
KFI, more stimulating talk radio.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. The Dark Secret Place. Brian sits in here until 10 p.m. Rahim Al-Afghani had a problem with Guantanamo, and it wasn't the food, because there's an average weight gain of 30 pounds at Guantanamo. It wasn't the availability of free Qurans or the scenery. It was another inmate at Guantanamo. You see, that other inmate had a cat, was allowed to have a cat as a pet. A former Maryland resident, in fact, who was detained at Guantanamo Bay, seems to have acquired a cat at the isolated prison on the U.S. base in Cuba. A fellow prisoner says in a letter released yesterday, Majid Khan, the cat owner, has not been seen in public since he pleaded guilty in February to aiding al-Qaeda in a deal that requires him to testify against others at Guantanamo. Details of his confinement are shrouded in secrecy, as he is one of about a dozen men that the Pentagon calls high-value detainees who are kept apart from others. The letter, which fell into the possession of the Washington Post, came from prisoner Rahim Al-Afghani, has one intriguing bit of information and little else. Quote, Majid Khan has a cat, close quote. He writes this to his lawyer, Carlos Warner, a federal public defender in Cleveland, Ohio. Warner released the letter after it had undergone the required government security review. He said he suspects that Majid Khan may have gotten a pet as a reward for agreeing to cooperate. He can't disclose anything else the prisoner has said about this or any other subject because Al-Afghani, the letter writer, the squealer, is also a high-value detainee, and everything he says, even to his lawyer, is considered classified. So the attorney, Carlos Warner, said in a phone interview, quote, I can't confirm or deny whether he wants an adorable kitten, close quote. So he included it in the letter. The assumption, no one knows. Was he complaining that another detainee had a cat? Or was it one desire to have a cat himself? Oh, he has more opinions, by the way. The 32-year-old Majid Khan, the cat owner, is expected to provide assistance to prosecutors in many cases to come, and perhaps even testify in the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 9/11 trial. Meanwhile, the letter writer, Al-Afghani, his lawyer, complained that the chief prosecutor for the Guantanamo Tribunal, General Mark Martins, has been unwilling to hold discussions with attorneys for other prisoners unless their clients agreed to cooperate with the government. In other words, He's using the cat as leverage. In his case, that might seem unlikely considering a second letter that Al-Afghani released, which references a famous side switcher, LeBron James, the NBA superstar known for ditching the Cleveland Cavaliers. They do get to watch TV at Gitmo. And evidently, you know, and basketball is, of course, soccer is the universal game and blah, blah, blah. But basketball is very popular. And what the guy wrote in the second letter released to the Washington Post is, LeBron James is very bad man. He should apologize to the city of Cleveland. The contents of both letters were first published yesterday in the Washington Post. Little is known about the letter-writing complainer, Mr. Al-Afghani. The Pentagon said he was transferred to Gitmo in March of 2008, that he was a high-level member of Al-Qaeda, a close associate of Osama bin Laden, evidently an NBA fan, formerly a Cavaliers fan. So that's that guy. And he's snitching that his fellow inmates have a cat. So here's America being hard on one of our own. A four-star Army general who was the first head of the it's about 8 years old now, the U.S. Africa Command, allegedly spent hundreds of thousands of dollars improperly on lavish travel, hotels, and other items for himself and his wife, according to a DOD report. When you have a big budget in the State Department, in federal service, but especially in the military, you are expected to account for every dime. Now, are they going to end your career because you slipped a little bit and you put too much dinner on your expense account? No, they're not. But what about a pattern? What about years of doing this? Well, we'll see. General William Kip Ward and his wife allegedly misused government resources for personal purposes, taking trips on military aircraft, using staff members to run personal errands. The report says, here's just a couple little examples. General Ward and his wife used military vehicles to shuttle to shopping malls and spas, billed the government for a refueling stop overnight in Bermuda, where the couple stayed in a $750 per night suite when it should have been just a brief refueling stop. He made the call and told the flight crew, I don't know, doesn't look good out there, we better spend the night. When I say that his wife was shuttled to shopping in military vehicles, I don't mean she got in a Bradley fighting vehicle or a Humvee. I mean that the Pentagon has thousands of cars, civilian cars, Dodge Durangos, Crown Victorias, you know, they have actual sedans. They have actual civilian cars with government plates, vans, whatever. So those are, you know, letter of the law. For these purposes, those are military vehicles. So during this trip, this is now, remember, this is the, well, there's a couple others. So they're flying back from Africa, from Burkina Faso to Kansas City. The flight crew, of course, they want to please the general, and they can give him a couple options on refueling. We can take off with all the fuel we need and get across the Atlantic, or we can take off with what we've got, and then, oops, we have to refuel in Bermuda. And that's basically what happened. In January of 2011, General Ward allegedly took an 11-day trip to Washington and Atlanta with an entourage of 13 military and civilian personnel, which cost $129,000, and he conducted less than 3 days of official business. During the trip, he visited wounded warriors one day, spent 90 minutes at Forces Command, ForceCom, on another day, and attended a meeting at the State Department a third day. He says he met with members of Congress during the trip, but they found no evidence or congressman who will support that claim. So there's that. It's a 99-page accounting of how he overspent. Some of it is fairly shocking. And then there's a bunch of little things like buying Snickers bars and things like that. In one instance, General Ward chose to stay at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City a day before his business in Birmingham, Alabama was to begin, even though a hotel in Birmingham would have been cheaper. You think? During four trips to Atlanta, Ward stated his intention was to meet with the commander of Forces Command. But according to the report, he never did. He only had four shots to contact another general. And so some of it is fairly shocking because when the guy, if it was just him, they might not have noticed it. But four-star generals don't travel with just him. They don't go anywhere without an entourage. And so this Bermuda thing, he and his wife, that was $750 a night. They went into a suite for $750 a night. They went there for one night. What about the entourage? Well, total it up, $10,700. That's not counting the cost of meals, local transportation, and incidentals. So it looks pretty ugly for this guy. And what the Army will probably do is they'll reduce him in rank for retirement purposes. And effectively, the difference between what he would make as a four-star retired guy versus a three-star retired guy will pay back the government for what he overspent, you could say. But don't cry for him, because four-star generals or three-star generals are much in demand by a lot of private companies as consultants and members of the board and et cetera, et cetera. So he'll land on his feet, I promise you. When we come back to Iran and Israeli preparations for a 30-day war with Iran. What if it lasts 31 or 155? We'll talk about all that when we come back into the Dark Secret Place. Brian suits in here till 10 o'clock on KFI. And in the newsroom, Michael Crozier has the latest.
Thanks.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. The Dark Secret Place. Brian suits in here till 10. And we've been tracking over the past couple of years the buildup of military forces by the Chinese and by other Southeast Asian and Western Pacific nations as they respond to the Chinese buildup of the Chinese military. By the way, quick fun fact. Here's your quick little fun fact for you. While the Chinese accounting and how they, you know, value their own currency, because that's how we know that they release what they spend in Chinese currency on defense, and they're kind of fudging the value of that, so we have to guesstimate what it is, right? But the ratio of where they spend it, you know, that tells us a lot as well. We don't have to worry about exchange rates there. So the fun fact is this. The Chinese do spend more on internal security year over year over year than they do on external defense. So regardless of the growth of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, as well as the Navy and the Air Force and all that, while it might seem intimidating to a lot of Western think tanks and all that, keep in mind that as they get more prosperous and more internet-y and more Twittery and the whole thing, the Chinese are increasing their budget for internal security. And the defense budget has never exceeded the internal security budget. So if you're wondering what their priorities are not to build aircraft carriers and then drop anchor off San Diego. Their priorities are, number one, stay in power and then exert control over the South China Sea. So with that being said, remember now the last couple of weeks we've seen this bizarre exchange between China, South Korea, and Japan about disputed islands here, hither and yon. Just north of Taiwan is a pair of islands that the Japanese call Senkaku. The Chinese call it Daiyo. And the Japanese administer them and have sovereignty over them. They won them in 1905. They administered them till 1945 when they lost to us. We administered them till 1971 when one day someone said, "What's Senkaku?" And we gave them back to the Japanese. Well, the Chinese have claimed them, are you ready, since the 14th century. Hey, there you go. So it's not about the islands. We know this. It's about the economic zone around the islands and all the natural gas or petroleum underneath them. So you recall last week the president of South Korea embarrassed the Japanese because there's a dispute over some islands between South Korea and Japan. So that's going on. The South Korean president visited the island and raised the profile of the thing. The Japanese were deeply offended by this because they want to negotiate the whole thing. Okay, so that's physically between Korea and Japan. Down south, there's a Chinese-Japanese standoff. Some Chinese, apparently, they're not saying who these people were, but Somehow some Chinese citizens came to the island and landed illegally. They were detained by Japanese authorities. They were held for 3 days, and they returned to China as great heroes on Thursday. So the Japanese, not to be outdone, a group of 150 civilians, including some members of parliament, have gone to the island to reassert the Japanese claim of sovereignty on the island. And, oh, by the way, all the oil and natural gas underneath it. Here's a report from the scene.
Asserting their country's territorial sovereignty, politicians and nationalists from Japan set off for the Senkaku Islands. The flotilla of 20 boats has angered China, which also lays claim to the archipelago, calling it the Diaoyu. It's demanding that Japan ceases any further provocation.
But the contingent... So now we go, the next scene, what you're hearing is a throng of Chinese civilians welcoming back to Beijing by flight the Chinese who were detained by the Japanese just a few days ago. They went there to make the point that these islands are Chinese. The Japanese disagreed, arrested them, sent them back to Beijing. This is them getting off the plane at the airport.
It's a strong response to the group of Chinese who landed there earlier this week. After a two-day detention, the activists were expelled back to Hong Kong.
I said Beijing. They were sent back to Hong Kong.
We set off this time to awaken and raise the concerns of all Chinese people that the Diaoyu Islands are Chinese.
Bottom line on this dispute, it seems like a small thing and a weird petty thing to have groups of civilians planting flags on the same piece of rock back and forth. This, you know, the Syria thing, the Iran nuclear thing, the Olympics, that is not the top of the headlines in China. There's 1.2 billion people who are all pissed off tonight about what happened to less than 100 of their citizens, of their countrymen who landed on these disputed islands. And that the Japanese, yes, those Japanese, perhaps you recall them from the rape of Nanking. Perhaps you recall them from the occupation of China. Yeah, those Japanese rounded up their countrymen, held them for 3 days, mind you, 3 days, and then sent them back to Hong Kong. And now, to make matters worse, some Japanese nationalists have gone to those islands. So this is what the headlines are in China right now. And make no mistake, what is happening within China is that there is now because it's inarguably no one has a sense of history that goes further back than the Chinese people. A near linear sense of history that goes back 5,000 years. And the Chinese are now on the cusp of an era where they can honestly say, after all we've done as a civilization, after all the development we've done and been held down by the British or whoever occupied us, then the Japanese, finally we're in a position where we don't have to take that stuff. Maybe 50 years ago or 60 years ago, we had to take that from the Japanese. Not now. No, we don't. And that's what's going on. And this is just, to us, it seems silly and small. Here's what could happen. Next time a group of Chinese civilians land on this island, there might be a group of Japanese civilians on the island. And one of them throws a rock at another one. Another one gets a stick. That's what could happen. And what happens next? Guess what? The Chinese Navy is offshore to rescue their wounded countrymen. The Japanese don't give them permission to land. The Chinese don't care. They land a helicopter with troops. The Japanese lodge a complaint. The Chinese leave a detachment behind. You see where I'm going with this? And this could be happening right now. And I don't think we really understand the scale of animus between these two countries. I mean, I know that Americans don't understand the scale of the antipathy that the Koreans feel for the Japanese. Certainly not the Chinese feeling towards the Japanese. Because you can see it here, manifested over these tiny islands. Again, draw a circle 200 miles around the tiny islands and you have a lot of oil. That being said, there is the point of pride. So anyway, the Japanese, rather than just hoping the incident goes away, some Japanese nationalists with members of parliament went to the island to respond to the Chinese nationalists.
Territory.
The islands are small, remote, and uninhabited. but the surrounding waters are thought to be rich in resources.
You think?
The Beijing government is renewing calls for Japan to pursue dialogue and resolve the dispute.
And that's the old playbook. The Chinese are calling for dialogue and peaceful discussion, but they'll send their navy offshore. The Japanese are terrified, are absolutely terrified of having to defend themselves. Because it's a different breed of Japanese that exists to this day.
Islands after invading Taiwan in 1895. It administered them.
Oh, I already gave you the history lesson. So anyway, some Japanese civilians went and had a picnic on the island. The Japanese government didn't stop them, and the Chinese government didn't stop the Chinese people. So the thing in the back of my mind, the little asterisk that I give on this, the handicap I give on this, is... sometimes big wars start over little things. And this could be that deal where everyone is head faking and looking at the Middle East. And maybe that takes care of itself. Maybe the Israelis tell the Iranians, we have nukes. And when you get nukes, guess what? We're going to nuke you if you nuke us. So just don't use them. Maybe that takes care of itself next 6 months. And oddly enough, I have more faith in that taking care of itself than I do in a conflict that is being driven by mobs of people getting off of boats on disputed islands. But we'll see. When we come back, what is, according to an Israeli website, an Israeli source, what is the agreement that the Obama White House has made about the when and where the United States strikes Iran as long as the Israelis don't do it before us, before the presidential election? That and more coming up one last time on the Dark Secret Place. Brian sits in here till 10 p.m. on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
KFI News.
Live and local all weekend long.
KFI AM 640.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio, the Dark Secret Place, one last time. And the Dark Secret Place can be heard on this one satellite radio thing on Sunday nights. I only mention that because of the different time formats. I have to add original material to that, which I will soon make available on the Facebook page, which is Dark Secret Place on KFI Los Angeles. That's the name of the DSP Facebook page. All right, so I read for you last hour the overview of how Israel could how it would prosecute a 30-day war with Iran by use of conventional ballistic missiles as well as cyber attacks and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And again, just for your own information, for cocktail parties or backyard drunken barbecues, the reason a cyber attack is so effective on the Iranians is because the Iranians, apparently Farsi doesn't have a word for copyright or software. The Iranian government, never mind people in school or kids in high school, the Iranian government is powered by pirated software. And pirated software is easily malware. It's easily hacked. Exhibit A, Stuxnet. That piece of malware crippled the Iranian government. Never mind the nuclear program. It crippled the bus system in Iran. This is very underreported. Why didn't Stuxnet bring down SoCal Edison? Because they own the software they're using. They paid the licensing fee. How about Comcast? The same deal. How about DirecTV? Ooh, same deal. But if you're using pirated software, guess what? Stuxnet is here for you. All right, so according to an Israeli source, there has been an agreement. With the release of this Israeli memo, the White House panicked and came to an accord with the Israelis about the outcome in Iran. The White House this week scrambled to reconnect with Jerusalem after the Obama administration was persuaded that Israel was serious about conducting a fall military operation before the November 6th U.S. presidential election. That is what that 30-day pitch was, that 30-day war plan was. Its intended effect, was it to make the White House know the Israelis were serious? I don't know, but it did do that. So the White House said, all right, we'll come to an agreement that regardless, we will attack Iran in spring. So according to the Israeli source, there are 4 points. Point one, President Obama will formally inform Congress in writing that he plans to use military force to prevent Iran from arming itself with a nuclear weapon. He will request their endorsement. Aside from this step's powerful deterrent towards Iran's leaders to give up their pursuit of a nuclear bomb, it would also give the U.S. president the freedom to go to war with Iran when he sees fit. Number two, to underscore the commitment, President Obama would pay a visit to Israel in the weeks leading up to Election Day and deliver a speech to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, solemnly pledging to use American military force against the Islamic Republic if Tehran still refuses to give up its nuclear weapons program. And using those words, not flowery rhetoric, but actually saying those words. Point three, in the coming months up until spring of 2013, the U.S. will upgrade Israel's military, intelligence, and technological capabilities so that if either a reelected Obama or Mitt Romney decides to back out of the military commitment, Israel will have in place the resources necessary for inflicting mortal damage on the Iranian program. So they're doubling down on the guarantee. And finally, point four, which is this. If points one through three can be covered and Netanyahu is convinced the U.S. really means to strike Iran next spring, according to sources in Israel, Jerusalem may be coming around to agreeing to hold back a lone Israeli attack this autumn. So sources report that President Obama has not rejected the plan. National Security Advisor Donilon was told to keep on talking to Netanyahu and Barak. So it becomes pretty clear that that thing released by a blogger, the Israeli 30-day war plan against Iran, was a shot across Obama's bow that, listen, we've advanced our planning to the stage where we can now brief it. Our planning is now, the ink is dried on the plan. We're now briefing the plan to the war cabinet, and this is what we envision. And it's funny because all the American pundits who are talking about Israeli aircraft, multiple missions over Iraq, this long range to Iran and back, they absolutely lack the imagination or knowledge of the Israeli military that the Israeli plan would involve a first wave of software attack and then ballistic missiles launched from Israel that don't require anyone's permission to go through their airspace, cruise missiles launched from submarines, and then the follow-up attacks would be from fixed-wing aircraft, and the fixed-wing aircraft would not be taking off from Israel because the assumption from the Israelis is that their air bases are going to be targeted by the Iranians. So why even plan for that? The Israeli aircraft would take off from Azerbaijan and Georgia. Shorter route, direct route, head fake, the Iranians wouldn't see it coming. So anyway, the plan was specific and realistic enough that, according to Israeli sources, it got the White House to sit up and take notice because the White House feels that an Israeli attack would guarantee that Obama doesn't get reelected. All right, so as I say, I put links up to some of the books that we're talking about. Our author, Dan King, we thank him very much for joining us tonight from Orange County, the author of The Last Zero Fighter, a tremendous book. I put a link up to the book. You can learn more about it. Also, as I was talking about reading about military failures, I put a link up to the book I referenced called Hell in a Very Small Place. All of that is at the Facebook page, which is Dark Secret Place on KFI Los Angeles. So join it, won't you please? And then I do update that thing. I get on there and I put stuff on there. I'll start putting videos and things like that on there. And we're going to expand the footprint of the website. It'll be of the Facebook page. And we're going to morph it into a larger website soon. So it'll be worth your while to go to it. I promise. So join us, won't you please, next week. Brian Suits back at 8 p.m. right here on The Dark Secret Place, or rather in The Dark Secret Place on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Michael Crozier with the news now.
Saturday, August 18th.
We don't need your approval, just your attention. Southern California's KFI.
Los Angeles, Orange County.
KFI News on the hour, on the half, and all weekend long.
Back and forth on Medicare. I'm Michael Crozier. On the campaign trail today in New Hampshire, President Obama says his Medicare plan will benefit everyone and questions who will benefit from the plan offered by Republicans.
My plan saves money in Medicare by cracking down on fraud and waste and insurance company subsidies.